For a long time, during the middle of the 20th century, it wasn't even clear what it meant to be a judicial conservative. Then, with great suddenness, during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, judges and lawyers on the right found a voice and an agenda. Their goals reflected and reinforced the political goals of the conservative wing of the Republican Party. Earl Warren, who served as Chief Justice of the United States from 1953 to 1969, exerted a powerful and lasting influence over American law. The former California governor, who was appointed by Dwight D. Eisenhower, put the fight against state-sponsored racism at the heart of his agenda. Starting in 1954, with Brown v. Board of Education, which outlawed segregation in public education, the justices began more than a dozen years of sustained and usually unanimous pressure against the forces of official segregation. Within the legal profession in particular, Warren's record on civil rights gave him tremendous moral authority. Warren and his colleagues, especially William J. Brennan, Jr., his close friend and strategist, used that capital to push the law in more liberal directions in countless other areas as well. On freedom of speech, on the rights of criminal suspects, on the emerging field of privacy, the Warren Court transformed American law. To be sure, Warren faced opposition, but many of his court's decisions quickly worked their way into the permanent substructure of American law. New York Times Company v. Sullivan, which protected newspapers that published controversial speech, Miranda v. Arizona, which established new rules for interrogating criminal suspects, even Griswold v. Connecticut, which announced a right of married people to buy birth control under the broader heading of privacy. All these cases, along with the Warren Court's many pronouncements on race, became unassailable precedents. Richard M. Nixon won the presidency in part by promising to rein in the liberalism of the court. But even though he had the good fortune to name four justices in 3 years, the law itself wound up little changed. Under Warren E. Burger, whom Nixon named to succeed Warren, the court, in some respects, became more liberal than ever. It was under Berger that the court approved the use of school busing, expanded free speech well beyond Sullivan, forced Nixon himself to turn over the Watergate tapes, and even, for a time, ended all executions in the United States. Roe v. Wade, the abortion rights decision that still defines judicial liberalism, passed by a 7-2 vote in 1973, with three of the four Nixon nominees, Berger, Lewis F. Powell, and Harry A. Blackmun, in the majority. Only Rehnquist, joined by Byron R. White, appointed by John F. Kennedy, dissented. Through all these years, from the 1950s through the 1970s, the conservatives on the court, like White and Potter Stewart, did not differ greatly from their liberal colleagues. The conservatives were less willing to second-guess the work of police officers and to reverse criminal convictions. They were more willing to limit remedies for past racial discrimination. They deferred somewhat more to elected officials about how to organize and run the government. But on the big legal questions, the war was over, and the liberals had won. And their victories went beyond the judgments of the Supreme Court. The Warren Court transformed virtually the entire legal culture, especially law schools. It was not surprising, then, that on the day after Ronald Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter in 1980, Yale Law School went into mourning. On that day, Stephen Calabresi's torts professor canceled class to talk about what was happening in the country. The mood in the room was one of bewilderment and hurt. At the end, the teacher asked for a show of hands among the 90 first-year students before him. How many had voted for Carter, and how many for Reagan? Only Calabresi and one other student had supported the Republican. The informal poll revealed a larger truth about law schools at the time. Most professors at these institutions were liberal, a fact that reflected changes that had taken place in the profession as a whole. The left-leaning decisions of the Warren and Berger courts had become a reigning orthodoxy, and support among faculty for such causes as affirmative action and abortion rights was overwhelming. But even law schools were not totally immune from the trends that were pushing the nation's politics to the right, and a small group of students like Calabresi decided to turn these inchoate tendencies into something more enduring. Along with Lee Lieberman and David McIntosh, two friends from Yale College who had gone on to law school at the University of Chicago, Calabresi decided to start an organization that would serve as a platform to discuss and advocate conservative ideas in legal thought. They considered several names that would showcase their erudition: the Ludwig von Mises Society and the Alexander Bickel Society. But they settled on a more elegant choice. They called themselves the Federalist Society, after the early American patriots who fought for the ratification of the Constitution in 1789. Calabresi's guide on the Yale Law School faculty was Professor Robert Bork. Lieberman and McIntosh started a Federalist branch at Chicago and recruited as their first faculty advisor a professor named Antonin Scalia.